The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
One of the mistakes that we make on the cybersecurity side a lot is when we think about cyber risk, we're almost always talking about, well, what's the cyber risk inside to my company? Like the unit of analysis is almost always the company. And that's useful, right? If we're thinking about financial risk, yeah, you can think about how risky is this particular firm. But there's also, I mean, the whole point of systemic stability is looking at even if every unit is making good risk decisions, there's still this risk between them and how that risk can get transmitted. So a lot of what we've had to do in our work is try to pull ourselves out of just thinking about the cybersecurity risk for that individual company itself. 10 years ago in the financial crisis, many financial institutions or companies or individuals that themselves made the right risk decisions got toppled over by those that didn't.
I'm Susan Hennessy, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, November 3rd, 2018. The rate and intensity of cyber attacks on financial institutions has increased in recent years, but the risk that these attacks pose to our financial stability remains understudied in the financial industry and among regulators and policymakers. What would it look like if malicious actors took direct aim at the systemic stability of U.S. financial institutions? On October 11th, I spoke to three senior research scholars from Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs who are taking early steps to find the answer. Catherine Rosen, former Deputy Assistant Treasury Secretary for Financial Institution Policy, Jason Healy, former White House Cyber Advisor in the Bush administration, and financial stability expert and former Federal Reserve official Patricia Mosser. We talked about how to understand financial stability, the unique risks that cyber threats pose to it, and what gaps remain in how to mitigate those risks. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 361, Cybersecurity and Financial Stability. So we're here to talk about your paper, The Future of Financial Stability and Cyber Risk. I think it might be the beginning of a new podcast series of even more things to be worried about. So obviously, sort of in the national security Lawfare world, we focus a lot on cybersecurity as it relates to national security, privacy, you know, even sort of in the financial sector, we think about it more as a security-focused concern. The three of you have authored a new paper, The Future of Financial Stability and Cyber Risk. You're talking about something different and broader than what we ordinarily talk about. So Catherine, I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about sort of the nature of your project just to set the scene.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for having us in discussing this. So Jay, Trish, and I come together through actually our prior lives and our current lives, where Trish being a financial stability expert with a long tenure at the Federal Reserve, Jay coming at this from a long tenure in cybersecurity policy, and myself serving at the Treasury Department, where both of these policy issues were on my agenda. In conversation with each other at Columbia, we realized that there were gaps. And we realize that as the question of cyber risk to financial stability has been asked, and it's been asked at a very high level, we realize that the two communities as a foundation were speaking with the same lexicon, but that the lexicon actually was misunderstood, that each community was using terms and phrases that were different. So what we set out to do is really address this lack of understanding of how cyber-specific risks interact with traditional financial stability vulnerabilities. That in itself raises the question of what's a vulnerability in cyber and what's a vulnerability in the financial world. At Columbia SIPA, we recognize we need to better understand how a cyber event can lead to a catastrophic event in the financial system. And this really required bringing together two distinct communities. One was the cybersecurity community and the financial stability community. And we also had to think about bringing together the public and private sectors. Cyber risk had not been well understood in the context of financial vulnerabilities and contagion channels. And as a foundation, we thought it was important to recognize that cyber folks and financial stability folks don't speak the same language, though confusingly, they often use the same words. So terms like risk and vulnerability and trigger and shock and confidence, contagion, to name a few. So we set out to bring these communities together. So in our recent work we published, and thank you for Brookings for putting this paper out, we really want to lay the foundation to understand the vulnerabilities in the financial system. So what are those conditions on the ground within this system that could lead to an event of financial stability? We discuss why cyber risks are different, and we go on to speak about what the channels, that transmission channel for cyber event to lead to financial instability. So that's kind of where we started our project, and we brought the three of us brought together our different disciplines to really attack the issue.
Yeah, so you sort of referenced that this is a relatively diverse group. How exactly did you all end up in the same room working on sort of this particular project?
It's one of the things I like about SIPA is that, you know, we ended up in these meetings. It was just Reese's peanut butter cup, like, oh, you know, like you've got your chocolate and your peanut butter, my chocolate, you've got your financial stability. And it was really great because Trish and I have both been at Columbia for 3 years. And so we're both about the same part of our programs and got ourselves established and then started looking around and seeing who else was doing interesting things. And especially it tied to work that we just finished on, it was called the New York Cyber Task Force, to say, what can we do to make cyberspace more defensible? And that included a lot of the bank chief information security officers, people like Greg Rattray and Phil Venables. So as we were finishing that, it seemed like a nice way to continue on that kind of work of looking at not trying to improve cybersecurity at the enterprise, but trying to look at these larger systemic issues.
So, Trish, I'm going to assume that our average listener knows about as much about economics as I do, which is probably relatively insulting to a large population of listeners, so I'm sorry. But I do think we sort of need a little bit of a basic economics lesson here. Whenever we talk about financial stability, what are we talking about?
So the basic definition of financial stability is maybe a better term would be resiliency rather than stability. We don't literally mean that there aren't shocks and volatility in financial markets. There are, and there should be. That's the nature of the beast. Pricing risk is going, it leads to that those sorts of changes. But the resilience of the system to resist very significant shocks and not collapse the way it did 10 years ago, to not have that happen, that's financial stability. I will get to directly answering your question about and give a little more background about financial stability in a minute. But one of the things I think that was important about the three of us getting together on this topic was that financial stability has been very well studied over the years, particularly the last 10 years. And certainly, while there's not complete agreement, there are definitely common approaches that are being used by those in the research community and those in the public policy community and public institutions, central banks, and so forth, about how to think about financial stability. Similarly, in the cyber world, there's a set of common approaches. Those two approaches kind of don't communicate with one another at all. And so the point of this paper and the ongoing project is to sort of try to bridge that gap. So back to financial stability. The approach that financial stability research and monitoring takes is actually not to look at the shocks to the financial system, but to assess the stability of the system as a whole. If you like, what are the measures and metrics that can tell us whether a system for any shock could withstand it or might have a very adverse reaction and we could end up in a very bad situation like we were 10 years ago. Cyber is different. It looks at it sort of, let's stop the shock itself after all. And so first of all, that difference in approach required us to sort of go back to square one. So where do we start? Well, let me start with a simple statement, which is that financial systems, all types of financial systems, are inherently fragile. And that means that they occasionally have crises. The good news is that these crises are pretty rare. The U.S. ate almost 80 years from between them. But they're also really hard to predict, and it doesn't, the shocks and the triggers are kind of irrelevant. Basically, the system gets so unstable that it's like the straw that broke the camel's back. Some shock is going to knock it over. So what are the characteristics of financial systems that make them fragile? Because if you're going to understand how cyber impacts that stability, you better understand where the weak spots are. So here are some of the characteristics. If you like, these are the things that amplify shocks in financial systems. Although the term of art in the financial stability world is vulnerabilities, and as Catherine pointed out earlier, vulnerabilities is used completely differently in the cyber world, just to give a really concrete example. So what are the things that make financial systems fragile? A few characteristics: leverage and maturity transformation, meaning using borrowed money, and particularly using short-term money that's borrowed and who the people who've lent you the money think the money is relatively safe, like a deposit in a bank, and use that to finance lending to long-term really risky assets. That's an inherently fragile system. If either the short-term money walks away or if the value of the asset falls, the whole structure can basically collapse. And the whole financial system is basically structured that way. Financial risk is also really highly pro-cyclical, meaning that the interaction of leverage and maturity transformation and human behavior means in the good times, prices are going up, everybody feels wealthier, everybody wants to borrow more, everybody buys more of that asset, and the price goes up again, and you get into this cycle, a positive cycle. And unfortunately, when the tide turns and you have a huge negative cycle in the other direction, as we learned again 10 years ago. Two other characteristics that we talk about in the paper. One is complexity, meaning interconnectedness, and basically finance is kind of opaque. It's sort of hard to understand how you evaluate what to buy and what to sell, for example, and at what price. I like to say the system is so interconnected that there's no such thing as an idiosyncratic shock in finance, because anytime one firm or one market gets shocked, there's an immediate reaction everywhere else. That's an exaggeration, but it's not a big one. Last but not least, the thing that really makes financial stability analysis hard is the system is always adapting and changing and innovative. You can think of fintech now, but there have been many, many innovations in the past. Every time the public sector or the private sector, for that matter, tries to put on a set of controls and dampeners, if you like, to sort of contain these unstable dynamics in the financial sector to try to make the system safer, that almost immediately gives someone the incentive to try to innovate around that or to innovate in ways that maybe accidentally get around it. Whether it's intentional or unintentional, the history of finance is that there's always new innovations coming in, and they very often make those dynamics even more unstable. So how does this get us all back to cyber? And I won't go all the way there because there are others here. My co-authors are much more expert than I. But cyber is all about preventing the shock in the first place. You know, you can't always do that. So what is it about cyber shocks that is different in terms of this dynamic we always have in the finance system? And to be more specific, what are the ways in which a cyber-specific attack and its transmission through technology channels could actually interact with all of those financial stability amplifiers that I was just talking about? Do they interact? And that's an open question. It's as something that hasn't actually been analyzed, and it's one of the things that we advocate in the paper. But that invites a couple of deeper questions. Are there particular participants, financial markets, financial institutions or structures, where there are financial vulnerabilities and the cyber vulnerabilities are high at the same time? Well, if there are, that's exactly the sort of area that probably deserves the most attention from both the private sector and the public sector. And then finally, to really think even more darkly about this, could it be that an actual cyber attack would be targeted at a very specific financial vulnerability in the system that we know about? Now, that hasn't happened to date. But it has to be, if you are in the cyber risk prevention business, something, and the financial stability business, something that you need to worry about.
So, Jay, you are the cyber guy in the room. Whenever you look at these rather complex systems that Trish is describing, and you think about what are the cyber risks, how do you think about that?
Yeah, thanks. And one of the mistakes that we make on the cybersecurity side a lot is when we think about cyber risk, we're almost always talking about, well, what's the cyber risk inside to my company? Like, the unit of analysis is almost always the company. And that's useful, right? If we're thinking about financial risk, yeah, you can think about what's how risky is this particular firm. But there's also, I mean, the whole point of systemic stability is looking at even if every unit is making good risk decisions, there's still this risk between them and how that risk can get transmitted. So a lot of what we've had to do in our work is try to pull ourselves out of just thinking about the cybersecurity risk for that individual company itself. 10 years ago in the financial crisis, many financial institutions or companies or individuals that themselves made the right risk decisions got toppled over by those that didn't. And so we're trying to bring the cybersecurity community along to think about those points. But it's also struck us in how much, to some degree with the cybersecurity community, but a lot with the financial stability side, doesn't think of how cyber risks are different, that you're dealing with an adversary that has their own intent. Many of our plans for cybersecurity as well as financial is, all right, if X happens, then we'll fix it by doing these things. Forgetting that this isn't just a failure, this is someone that's planned this to you, and as you respond and make things better, can keep hitting you in new and novel ways to make sure that you're going to knock over. And we especially think, and Trish mentioned this, they can attack at a time and place and a vulnerability of their own choosing. An adversary might say, choose to attack the finance sector to cause a financial crisis when there wouldn't have been one, when we are maybe teetering on the edge and maybe Putin decides to give us a little shove because he's been intermediated out of the dollar economy anyhow and he has very little to lose, or exacerbating it when we're already in. And just to close on my point, one of the examples that I like of giving us a push, imagine if we're teetering on the edge of a financial crisis and the GRU doxes, the Russian military intelligence doxes the emails of the Secretary of the Treasury, right? They steal his emails where he's talking with these bank CEOs on how we're going to fix that, and they release those emails. Like the collapse of confidence, the collapse of look at these dirty deals that these plutocrats are trying to do on our backs means that you're not going to save it. And it's not a fancy or sophisticated cyber attack, but it's exactly the kind of thing we've seen them do. And in things like that might be very effective.
So whenever we talk about risk and adversaries, there is always sort of the question of who has both the capacity and motivation here. So you've mentioned nation states. It also strikes me that nations are the most financially interconnected, and some of our traditional military adversaries would themselves face particular risks if there was broad financial instability or unpredictable financial instability in Western systems. So whenever you're thinking about this sentient bad guy adversary, is it nation states? Is it rogue actors? What level of sophistication are we talking about?
I think almost all of the conversations we've had have led us to the nation state side that has the significant capability and intent. I like watching Mr. Robot as much as the next person, which is this group of hackers that bring down the economy. But it really is pretty significantly hard for the amount of capability that you have to have. And it makes me think of a few things that we fall into, some traps. It doesn't have to be intentional from the attacker, right? It might be a mistake or a miscalculation on their side. And they had a capability and they only thought they were going to steal money or they only thought they were going to affect a single institution. And it ends up cascading, either cascading because of the cyber attack or it cascading because of some financial interconnectedness that they hadn't thought about. Some colleagues say, well, everybody's making money with this. Like, look at the Russians. Like, they're making so much on cybercrime. Why would they ever take it down? And to me, that's a very 1914 kind of argument, right? Of everybody, it should be stable, and yet we get ourselves in this position where it doesn't. And I'll just mention, I don't see it necessarily being China, because if they wanted to affect us, they've probably got other ways. They've got enough of our debt. They might have other ways. Can certainly see North Korea, right? I mean, they're already doing cyber heists. Like against the Bank of Bangladesh, trying to steal essentially $1 billion. And a lot of their malicious software, their malware, doesn't play nicely, right? It will self-destruct on its way out. if it thinks it's getting caught, and you could easily imagine that causing some kinds of collapse, even if they didn't mean it to.
So your comment does bring to mind one sentence that really jumped out at me as sort of a little bit counterintuitive. And so this is a question really to whoever wrote this sentence, which is that the complexity of technological dependence has sparked a related and growing concern that even unsophisticated actors might be able to trigger systemic effects. So it seems counterintuitive to me because what you're saying is the more technologically sophisticated these systems become, the less sophisticated you have to be to do harm. So whoever wants to claim responsibility, Catherine,
I don't recall writing the sentence, but I will tell you, and I'll get to this, is that, you know, we are uniquely situated in the financial services industry in terms of how we think about these issues, in the sense that amongst the industry sectors, I think we've been first to the party, whether we liked it or not. When you think about your question, that could as easily be a fat finger in terms of triggering an algorithm in trading, where we have the IT infrastructure for the financial services industry has become such interconnectedness that you can accidentally have something occur, have markets run with just that kind of action. And we've seen that. We've seen flash crashes. We've seen fat finger events. And we've seen catastrophic events happen in financial system. So I think when we come to this conversation, it comes with a lot of knowledge. It comes with a lot of bumps and bruises. It comes with a lot of introspection on how we think about contagion through the financial system. And in 2012, when we started, you know, taking on the first nation state DDoS attacks, getting back to Jay's comments about who does it need to be, we had to start asking the question, wow, can this really have a contagion effect like that of the financial crisis? And so the work really started, and the question started about how do we think about transmitting these risks? And so really the executive order from the Obama administration, I think it was 13636, said that the Department of Homeland Security should think about designating industries and corporations with industries as critical to infrastructure. And so we had to take an introspective view to our own sector and think about who should be designated for that list for a whole host of reasons. But I think that really kicked off this rise to the systemic outside the enterprise level that Jay referred to and really bringing it to a systemic level for us.
And if I can, it was probably about 20 years ago where I first heard, it was someone from the CIA say, the kinds of capabilities that nation states are now using, and again, this would have been no later than 2000, non-state adversaries are going to be using in 2 or 3 years. It was already a trend that we saw from the attackers back then. So we're 20 years into this. But it also, any complex system, especially one that's highly interconnected and tightly coupled, a failure in one place is extremely likely to cascade and become failures in other places. And both finance fits that definition, as does cyberspace. And I'll just leave with one quote. Dan Geer, who's taught me a ton in this business, said, the more technological a society becomes, the more it becomes reliant on distant digital perfection. And I just love that phrase for both what we're talking about, systemic cyber risk or systemic financial risk, that we're relying on this distant digital perfection. And we know we can't trust that anymore, but that's exactly what we're building.
So I want to add one thing about intent. So, and this is from the financial stability standpoint. Most analysis of financial stability, as I mentioned earlier, doesn't really focus on the nature of shocks at all. It's about the system, and any old shock could hit it. So in theory, a mistake, but a mistake with a complex cascade within technology around it is not something that financial stability is thinking about very, very much at all. The other side of that, and one that we discuss in this paper, is of course the actual idea of, let's start with a financial stability vulnerability over here, a piece of the financial system that we know is vulnerable and is important and can lead to a lack of confidence, a partial shutdown of markets, whatever. And if you do have a very sophisticated attacker who wants to create havoc, then back-channeling through that to figure out where the cyber vulnerabilities are, and we know that intent and timing can be picked if the attack is successful. There is a possibility. This has not been done to my knowledge yet, but there's no question that there is a potential that a very sophisticated, intentional attack could go after a piece of the financial infrastructure that would intentionally cascade through multiple institutions and multiple markets. That, I mean, that's my sort of doomsday scenario, more so than the accidents, although either one, as Ajay and Catherine said, could cause instability.
So this is sort of a good tee up to something that Catherine referenced earlier, this notion of transmission channels. So before we started recording, you were joking at sort of how a bill becomes a law. So walk us through this. How does a cyber event or incident, particularly an intentional one, result in this sort of cascading, destabilizing effect?
Sure. So one, I think that we've laid the foundation that we need to have something on the ground, conditions on the ground in the financial system that are fragile, right? So we need something, at least that's our assumption, we need something already to be unstable to really get us to that catastrophic event. But there's a number of channels, and we call them channels. I you can visually think about it as a conduit. You can think about it as a behavioral or as an atmosphere. We focus on five, three of which we borrow from the Office of Financial Research's work from, I think, 2014. They wrote a paper thinking through this, and we've added a few. One is this notion of lack of financial substitutability. The financial system has at its core institutions, utilities that are paramount to market functioning. So whether that's custody of securities, whether that's clearing and settling of securities, there are a number of functions that actually rely on one, two significant hubs. If we have an event that would somehow disrupt, corrupt, slow down the core infrastructure, and you could say the ICT infrastructure of these entities, you could have some transmission channel that will result in those entities not being able to function. They're no longer substitutable. We don't have a backup for those institutions. So we think about that for a number of our utilities. Secondly, loss of confidence, I think Trish referred to, and a lot of these issues leap to loss of confidence. And that's what's something that would create your traditional bank run. Why do investors or lenders start to pull away from the market due to a cyber event? Another would be data integrity. You could have a cyber trigger, which is either corrupting or destroying data. Also leads to a loss of confidence. But that data integrity alone could propagate through the system. We've added two more. This notion of lack of substitutability is really important in IT infrastructure because so many of our institutions and functions are increasingly relying on technology that we could have many single points of failure within technology. So you have corporate IT is starting to become very similar, growing reliance on the cloud with few providers, other areas that just become more and more interconnected, but yet there's core functions for IT. And then the last one we added is this notion on its own of interconnectedness. These contagion channels from both financial systems and IT infrastructure is due to this complex web. And that's where you can quickly transmit a cyber event into an event of financial instability.
So as I'm hearing you talk about these potentially catastrophic risks, we know that this has been designated by DHS as sort of part of systemically important institutions and critical infrastructure. I do wonder what your thinking is on sort of what is the role of the government in especially providing different forms of information sharing. So the financial sector has always been relatively good or sort of forward-leaning of sharing information with one another. It does strike me that the way we think about sharing cyber threat indicators or sharing intelligence sort of from the government intelligence community into banks, we tend to think about it sort of more in that technical cyber threat indicator context, and that we think about it really differently than, say, intelligence surrounding a terrorism event, right? In that case, one, there's very specific targeted types of collection, right? You're going out there, you're hearing from, for example, banks, what types of risks do you expect? You go out and try and find information, and then you're feeding it back into these institutions in a kind of left of boom sense. Is that missing? Is that occurring here? Do we need, you know, whenever you're describing an impact that is certainly as destabilizing and potentially catastrophic as sort of your an ordinary, you know, terrorism event, do we really need to have a shift in sort of national security and intelligence community thinking for how we should be thinking and information sharing around this?
Yeah. So, and, you know, I used to be the vice chairman of the FSISAC, so the group that was there to do this information sharing. And we've moved pretty far beyond just information sharing because, right, we're not going to share our way out of systemic risk any more than if information flows about financial risk that it's going to. I mean, you still have the inherent fragility of the system. You still have these vulnerabilities are going to happen. You still have adversaries that are going to want to attack regardless. So we've been, as we've been doing this work, we've been working with the banks and also with the new FSARC that have stood up, Financial Stability Analysis and Resilience Center. So moving beyond just the sharing of information to saying, let's not aim for sharing, let's aim for resilience and do the things that we need to do to achieve resilience, which isn't just sharing. And so there's been great to work with them as we do that. And I'm especially interested in these areas of these operational collaboration of where we can come together and help work these issues out.
I think the advantage of that approach, too, is that it is thinking about the system as a whole. I'm referring back to something that Jay said earlier about getting beyond thinking about the safety of your individual institution and considering the safety of the entire system. Now, on the business side of finance, that's always hard to do because they're competitors, after all, with each other. But the idea that from a cyber attack shock standpoint, one shouldn't be thinking about those spillovers is a bit of what is part of what FSARC is actually going for and working toward, I think. And in my view, well outside the whole national security apparatus, that next step from beyond information sharing to actively considering different scenarios and different spillover effects, I think is pretty critical to do.
So as we have conversations around cybersecurity, a lot of time there is a tendency to focus on the most difficult and complex problem to solve, sort of at the expense of kind of the low-hanging fruit, the things that there could be, you know, immediate practical progress on. You know, whenever you're looking through your concerns and recommendations, you know, is there a category here of, hey, here's the easy stuff that we should be doing and aren't, and then this is a different category of, you know, the really, really complex, challenging problems? You know, is there a way to sort of separate this stuff out into two buckets?
I would suggest that all of this is hard work. So I don't know if that's the opposite of easy in the sense. I mean, if you look at the areas where we really focus and where our concerns lie and where our recommendations stem from, we speak to issues like fragmentation in regulation, fragmentation in governance, both domestic and globally. To get that to a level playing field, it takes a lot of work because especially in the U.S., we have so many different bodies of interest that would have to come together to do that. I think that's important. And it's not just us, the folks who are doing this every day think it's important. It's how do you get there? How do you inspire that? I will throw out one other thing that sounds easy, but is so critical and foundational, and that is understanding the plumbing in both of these sectors better, financial plumbing and IT plumbing, and how these things relate. We call them maps for a vernacular. How do you map the system? Really hard work that the government has started with the input of regulators and financial industry, work the financial industry has done on its own. We've all participated in conversations and helping actually put boxes and arrows on very large pieces of paper to do this. And yet you will see that we're still calling for maps because you have to really get to this subterranean level of where the technology plugs into the market functioning. And how do you do that? I'll throw it to you guys for other thoughts.
I've got two. One, we're doing some follow-up work that's a general framework of how cyber risks can cause financial instability. It might even, with the new National Risk Management Center that DHS has set up, be a cyber risk to any sector and look at how the transmission paths. Because what we're trying to do in that work is, like Catherine said, this is really hard. We're hoping that providing a general model, we can make it simpler. So that way, when people are saying, good, we have to analyze this, they at least have a template that says, in general, here's how these things go, as Catherine talked about, right? We've got the cyber risk, the financial stability, we've got the transmission channels in the middle. And we're hoping that's going to make it repeatable because it's hard, but at least we make it simpler. And then for me, more broadly, I like improving response, because improving response, I don't have to hit any of the core public policy goods that collide. When you're in response, everybody is pretty much, hey, let's fix this. And so I'm very interested in things like governance, right? You know, what can we do now to improve the conversation between cyber and finance, between US and others? Just think 10 years ago when the finance crisis hit, we had people like Trish that were in the right jobs. We had groups like the G7. We had the IMF. We had the Bank for International Settlements. And even when those didn't work, you could go from the G7 to the G20 because you had that foundation, you had the conversations. On cyber stability, we don't have any of that. You know, we've kind of got, you know, we've got ICANN, we've got the ITU, I guess. But if we needed to have that conversation of the U.S. President, Prime Minister Abe, Angela Merkel with the heads of the major cyber companies, right? There's no structure to do that. A few years ago, Microsoft proposed a G20 plus ICT20. So the G20 countries plus the top 20 systemically critical internet and communication companies. And they wanted that for norms. I thought it was great for response, because at least then you're having that conversation. And when things break, you can just pick up the phone and you can get a bunch of the right people in the room, even if it's not all the right people.
So I have two items. The first one, which I think may be the only true piece of low-hanging fruit, is about the lexicon. It is amazing the number of times that we have conversations and we end up talking past each other, let alone talking past whether we're speaking to the financial stability group or a group of cyber experts. And you realize after a few minutes that the terminology that I'm using is not consistent with Jay's, and it's not consistent with what other people in the room want. So to their credit, the Financial Stability Board has put out the first round of a lexicon, and we think that's great. I will say that it probably has more resonance with the financial stability community than it does with the cyber community. I think it would be lovely to have a parallel list and line them up. That's possible to do and not an enormous amount of work. So that if you were going to ask a low-hanging fruit, that would be one. So at least we can communicate clearly with each other. I want to also go to the international arena, but I, in addition to the preparedness, I do want to go to the norms and the regulations and the policies. There's a long history, of course, in finance of international coordination, because particularly on the regulatory side, through the Basel Committee on Bank Supervision and other groups like that. And that's pretty critical in creating a global level playing field in finance. And we know what happens when you don't have a level playing field. You have exactly that adaptation and innovation in the market, and the water and the risk all flows downhill to the place where it's least expensive to hold, which means the world still has the risk, even if a particular country doesn't. And if 10 years ago taught us nothing else, is there's no such thing as a domestic financial crisis anymore. They're all pretty much global. And given that, the idea that I think you just have to have this conversation about not only the details of cyber resiliency and response, but the details of what the norms are on an international basis. That has really barely started. It has started. That's good. And we document, in fact, in the paper, a number of the venues and the papers and so forth that have been written on this topic. But there's quite a ways to go. And frankly, most countries are substantially further behind the U.S.
Two things that I want to mention that came out when Trish was talking. One, I do want to call out the great work that the Carnegie Endowment has been doing, because they've been looking at, for example, not just proposing a norm that states don't cause destabilizing attacks to the finance sector, but really going around to the countries and the Financial Stability Board and really enrolling folks and making it happen, which I don't normally expect for a think tank, but they've really been making it happen. So great work. And listening to Trish reminds me that, you know, there's only really two sectors that are truly global,
like oil and gas, kind of, right? We've got pipelines. But finance and the internet, cyberspace, are those that really are interconnected and live globally. Now, there's a phrase that came to me when 2008 was happening was banks live globally but die locally. Like when things start to go bad, the nation state, the sovereign will come in and say, here's things, and chop them off, even if that's going to hurt other states that were relying on that money to be moving. And so I'm sitting here saying, boy, what does that happen? What are these lessons for cyberspace from finance, right? And you can imagine if you start having this bad situation that maybe the governments are going to come in much, much more now and say, all right, AT&T, boom, we're now coming in as the sovereign. Deutsche Telekom, boom, the EU and Germany come in. Microsoft, Apple, in ways that are significantly much more than we see now.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.
We did enjoy it.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Catherine, Jason, and Patricia for coming on the podcast. If you haven't done it yet, please give us a rating and review wherever you found us and share us with your friends and followers on Twitter and Facebook. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Pachihal, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.